True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Her frustrations with Rob became my frustrations. Her demons became my demons. I had a frank disgust for him that was developing. As ironic and sad as this sounds, for Rob's sake, she expressed that he would honestly rather be dead than divorced. I planned to confront Rob directly into Atropy. I was definitely armed to kill him. However, I wasn't sure of if I'd do that or not. I really didn't want to leave him if he wasn't entirely dead. So I went back around the backside of the truck and quickly fired one more shot at him. Later on, that produced more just a feeling, and I'm sorry this sounds bad, but of relief.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Support for this podcast comes from Park Row Books, publisher of Under My Skin by New York Times bestselling author Lisa Unger. Under My Skin is an addictive psychological thriller about a woman on the hunt for her husband's killer. Poppy is determined to unravel the mystery around her husband's death. But can she handle the truth about what really happened? Listen to the audiobook for Under My Skin today.
From the outside, Rob and Sabrina Limone looked like a really happy couple. They had two healthy children, they were affectionate, energetic, and they had a lot of friends. Their lives were filled with parties, barbecues, and boating trips. But the Limones had secrets. They had an open marriage, swapping partners with some of their closest friends. Then Sabrina began an intense romantic relationship with a 22-year-old firefighter. This would be the beginning of the end. Two shots one night at a warehouse building where Rob worked ended his life. Investigators didn't have to look far to find his killer. Today, in Death Before Divorce, we look into a flawed marriage, one with secrets that allowed something evil to creep in. What started with infidelity and deception led to an obsessive affair and ended with the violent death of a husband and father.
Okay, so we need a beer. And we need a California beer. So I picked one called Parabola from Firestone Walker Brewing Company in Paso Robles, California. This is a Russian Imperial Stout that's been aged for a year in a blend of bourbon barrels. And it packs a bit of a punch. It's 12.7% alcohol by volume. So it's almost black colored with a very minimal to zero head. So it just looks kind of like an oil slick, you know. Maybe that's not a pleasant description, but...
But you like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice aroma, roasted malt, some dark fruit, toffee, and you can sense the alcohol there. And then in the taste, we got some dark chocolate, coffee, raisins, toffee, and bourbon. Bourbon's noticeable, but doesn't detract from the taste at all. Enhances it. Very nice.
Very nice. Okay, let's open it up.
Yeah, we got to go slow with this one, so we'll share it.
Okay. Okay, moving on down to the quiet end, and we do have more and more people coming in.
Yeah, what are these? They look like a bunch of hipsters.
I think they're hipsters. I think you've hit it on the head there.
Well, geez, they're way too cool for us.
They're very cool, but this is kind of a cool place. I see that they've added some specialty drinks to the menu.
Yeah, the ones with umbrellas in them and all, right?
Yeah, in an ironic way, because they're hipsters, right?
Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
And we're definitely too old for it, but they probably like us because we're like vintage people. They like vintage stuff.
Yeah, and that's us.
Yeah.
Particularly me. I'm very vintage.
Yes. So as far as their beer tastes go, I see that they really do like the Pabst Blue Ribbon. What's with that? That's like a cool thing. Is that another ironic thing?
I think so.
Because they also like the microbrews.
They do, but they really get off on PBR. and some of the older ones. A lot of them are drinking Narragansett. That's an old-timey beer from New England. So, yeah. And there's a bunch of new cocktails, as you said.
Right. I might try some out because, you know, I'm not faithful to beer all the time.
I know that.
Okay. I'm excited about the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, anything that gets more people in the bar, keep it going. So we don't have to find another place to broadcast from.
No, not at all. And I like these people because they seem like they want to do things for the environment and, you know, I think overall they're good people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes a little pretentious, but who isn't?
Right. I think that's part of the irony of the whole thing, if I'm getting it right.
Oh, we probably aren't because we're not hip.
Right. So maybe some actual hipsters could write in or leave us a voicemail and just kind of clue us in on this whole thing.
Yeah, what we're getting wrong.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Why don't you go ahead and start our story today?
Okay. We're starting in 2014, an hour before sunset on Sunday, August 17th, 2014. Sean Ware drove his work truck into the Summit Industrial Park, which is a complex of commercial buildings. Warm summer evening there in the desert. Traffic noisily moved past on Highway 58, cars and trucks moving between Bakersfield and the Mojave Desert. Every half hour, a freight train from Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway would rumble by behind the park. So as he arrived for his overnight shifts, Sean immediately felt something wasn't right. He noticed that the metal door to the work area was closed. Now, the day shift responder, Rob Lamone, would have kept it open to keep some degree of ventilation in the hot garage. I mean, this is the desert. Temps are in the 80s and 90s.
Sure. Yeah, you want ventilation.
And the other thing is that Rob would have notified Sean if he were out on a service call. So Sean raised the garage door with his remote opener. He saw that Robert's utility truck was parked next to his personal car, which was a silver Honda. Sean walked into the garage along the right side of the truck and almost stepped on some broken glass that had come from one of the fluorescent fixtures hanging from the 18-foot ceiling. On Sean's right, the door to the small office was open. Now, this was wrong, too. The office door always stayed closed. But the office had been ransacked. File drawers had been opened, papers were thrown all over the floor. A work laptop was missing. Sean walked around to the front of the work truck, which pointed toward the kitchenette on the back wall. The door of the small refrigerator was flung open. So was the door to the bathroom. And that's when he saw Robert.
So this looks like some kind of a robbery. Maybe some drug dealers out for cash. It is kind of an isolated area.
It's an isolated area. It's a weekend, a Sunday, so not much traffic in the park, in the area. So, yeah, I guess that would be my first impression.
Mm-hmm.
Something's not right, and it looks like the place has been ransacked.
Right, but it's a lot more than a robbery because 38-year-old Rob Lamone was on the floor. His back was slumped against the driver's side tire of the truck. Sean kneeled beside him to see if he was okay, which clearly he wasn't, and Rob had this vacant look on his face with one eye closed and the other half open. There was blood pooled underneath him as well. He was unresponsive. So Sean was shocked and horrified by this. He called 911 on his cell phone, and he told the operator that he'd found his co-worker on the ground with a lot of blood and that he was not responsive. So following the operator's instructions, Sean pulled Rob down flat on his back and attempted to perform CPR. But with the first chest compression, some congealed blood oozed out of Rob's mouth. So this was not a good sign.
This is not a good sign.
So we know here we have a murder victim, and the operator told Sean to just get out of the building and wait for help.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, the guy who did this to Rob might still be there.
Exactly. It's a dangerous situation.
He should get out of there.
Mm-hmm. And Sean had his cell phone to his ear with the 911 operator on the line as he walked out to this asphalt parking area. A man came up to him, and it was somebody who worked in a neighboring business. And he asked Sean what was going on. So Sean, all he could say was, "I think Rob's dead." And then I guess this is when reality really hit him hard. You know, sometimes when you say something out loud, it just really clicks that, oh my God, this is real.
Well, yeah, he's got all this adrenaline pumping through and boom, it hits.
Right. So Sean dropped to his knees and he was shaking uncontrollably. The next thing he knew, he heard cars approaching with flashing lights and sirens. He looked up and he saw a woman in a sheriff's uniform. That's when he pointed to the garage and he said, "He has two kids." Referring to Rob, of course. So two deputies from the county sheriff's office got this 911 call, and it was 6:46 p.m. for a male found bleeding and not breathing. Since it was a Sunday night, all of the garage doors were shut except for that one. The area was empty except for the man crouched on the pavement, Sean. Kern County Senior Deputy Marcus Moncur got there first, and he approached Sean, who was still shaking. A second deputy, Anna Alvarez, a rookie, arrived in her patrol car. Moncur asked her to stay with Sean and talk to him while he went and checked out the garage, which was about 50 yards away from them.
Yeah, once he got to the garage, the deputy saw the silver Honda and the white Chevy work pickup. On the ground next to the driver's side door of the pickup, he saw Rob Lamone flat on his back. He was a big man, about 6 feet tall, with a shaved head and a beard. Moncur could see that Rob had a lump on his eye and blood around his mouth and right cheek. A large pool of blood was congealed beneath his head and torso. Rob's body showed signs of lividity, which is the dark discoloration caused by blood pooling by gravity at low points in the body after the heart has stopped beating. So it looks kind of purplish-bluish, almost a bruise type of appearance. And behind Rob, blood was spattered on an open refrigerator door. Moncur radioed for a paramedic and walked out of the garage, careful not to step on any evidence. He asked Alvarez to rope off the area as a crime scene.
Well, it only took minutes for an ambulance and a paramedic truck to arrive, and two emergency medical technicians took Rob's vital signs and ran a field EKG. There were no signs of life. The EMTs called a physician at Kern Medical Center in Bakersfield, and they told her their findings. So at 7:06 p.m., Rob was officially declared dead. Over the next half hour, calls went out to investigators, crime scene technicians, and the coroner. Moncur started a crime scene log to help track the events, and he waited nearly an hour and a half for them to arrive. Now, Kern County, it's smaller than the entire state of New Jersey, but with 880,000 people, it only has a tenth of its population. So the county is made up of vast farmland, mountains, and just miles and miles of desert. So the closest detective was more than an hour's drive away. That's why it took so long.
Yeah, there's not much out there, is there?
No.
We've been to the Mojave.
We have. Very deserted.
Yeah, it's a desert.
That's right.
There's a lot of open space.
Even the neighborhood where these people lived was just built in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. And by 9 o'clock in the evening, the industrial park was lit up with emergency lights, and it was swarming with police. Behind the garage, they found footprints near the back door. They followed the same path as Sean had along the right side of the truck, stepping over the shattered glass. The fixture above was missing one of its two fluorescent bulbs, and there was some damage to the metal frame. On the ground, directly below the fixture, was a bullet. Through the office door, they could see a television, sofa, desk, and office chair, exercise machine, photocopy machine, whiteboard calendar, and two desks against the wall.
So a typical office.
Typical office. The bottom desk drawers were open, and file folders had been thrown on the floor. Two cell phones sat on the desk.
And one of those would turn out to be Rob's. Now, Sean told detectives that as Tehachapi responders, he and Rob worked 12-hour shifts, so they always worked alone. The 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift the night before was Sean's, and that day, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., was Rob Lamone's. The last time Sean had spoken to Rob was that morning during the 7 a.m. shift change. They talked about Rob's iPad, which hadn't been working. Then Sean slept all day before his overnight shift, and he had no idea what Rob had done during that day shift. Sean had worked with Rob off and on for about 2 years. He said that Rob was a very friendly guy. Rob was married with two kids, and he lived in a community called Silver Lakes in the town of Hellendale. So this was about an hour and a half drive away. Sean had never known Rob to use drugs or be involved in anything illegal, so he couldn't think of anybody who was an enemy to Rob. And Rob didn't usually work at that location. He was based far across the Mojave Desert to the east at Barstow Yard. According to Sean, Rob was filling in that Sunday for the regular responder named Corey Hamilton. Rob had taken the shift at the last minute. Sean also told investigators that the work truck in the garage, like all company trucks, had a forward-facing camera, which activated during accidents, so it's possible it could have recorded something. Now, one of those cell phones, like I said, did belong to Rob, and it had several missed phone calls and text messages on it. The last text came in at 8:30 p.m. from his wife, Sabrina. And it said, "Babe, I'm worried about you. Call me. Leanna wants to say goodnight." Leanna is Rob and Sabrina's daughter.
Yeah, I mean, by 8:30, he should have been home, or just about home.
Yeah, because change of shift at 7.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Hour and a half drive.
Plus, they seemed to communicate fairly often while he was at work, because he was alone there all day.
Right.
Unless he went out on calls.
Well, but like you said, it was an isolated place, and it was good to keep in touch with each other.
Sure. Well, it was 1:30 a.m. when Detective Meyer called Sabrina Lamone. She was at her home in Silver Lakes. And the house by that time was full of relatives, friends, and the two Lamone children, of course. They had a son, Robbie, who was 11 at the time, and Leanna, who was 8. When Sabrina's husband, Rob, hadn't come home and didn't answer his phone or her texts, she had called her older sister. Her name was Julie Cordova, and she also called their parents. All of them lived in Silver Lakes, and they all came over right away. So it was around 8:30 p.m. when a white Jeep had pulled up to the house. Two men from the railroad came to the house to tell Sabrina that her husband had died at work in Tehachapi. So it appeared that he had died of a head injury, and police were investigating, is all that they told her. So at that point, when the Jeep came at 8:30, she had fallen to her knees on the porch and started crying. And of course, the two little kids started crying too. Julie's husband was demanding more information from them, but they wouldn't give them any more information. And that's when Julie started making phone calls. She called Rob's sister, Lydia Marrero, at about 10:30 in the evening. She told her that there'd been a terrible accident and her brother was gone, and all Julie knew was that Rob had died while he was at work.
Corey Hamilton, the employee that Rob had been filling in for, had been a railroad employee for only a year. Corey had met Rob when Corey was hired in 2013. He knew Rob only through work. So he had family visiting from out of town, and Corey took sick days for that Saturday and Sunday. Another fill-in employee, John Justice, had covered the Saturday shift, but couldn't do Sunday. It was Justice who called Rob on Saturday and arranged for him to go to Tehachapi and work that Sunday. So Sabrina's sister and her close friend Kelly would say that Sabrina was devastated by her husband's death. The detective who called her that night also found her reaction to be what he would expect from someone in her situation. Nothing in Sabrina's demeanor raised red flags.
No, she really struck Detective Meyer as an upset and confused woman who really had no idea what was going on and what she was going to do without her husband. Now she's a mom with no husband,
right?
No father for her kids.
Yeah, this is a lot of stuff to take in.
Right. And she seemed like you would expect a woman in that situation to seem, at least over the phone.
Right. Because we talk about this a lot, how people don't act the way the police think they should act. So they get suspicious.
They do. And everybody admits that different people respond differently. But right. It's still something they're very judgy about.
They are.
Yeah.
So at least at this point, Sabrina has passed the appearances look.
Yeah. She did okay so far. So one of the investigators had tracked down the building's landlord and asked if the facility had any surveillance cameras. And there were several, including one at the entrance that was pointed toward the garage where Rob was killed. This entrance-mounted camera recorded a person that Sunday, looked like a man, wearing bulky clothes and carrying a dark bag. This hunched-over figure was limping past some trees in the direction of the garage at 5:21 p.m. 18 minutes later, at 5:39 p.m., the person could be seen limping back the opposite way. The face was too far away from the camera to be seen, and none of Rob's co-workers or other tenants there in the complex recognized this person.
So it's not likely it's someone who worked there.
Doesn't seem that way.
Now, 2 days after the murder, Detective Meyer released a video to the media and posted it on the Kern County Sheriff's Office YouTube page. A press release gave Meyer's phone number and texting information for the secret witness anonymous tip line. Also that night, the video played on the Bakersfield and Los Angeles news stations and posted on the websites of the local newspapers. So we're getting the word out.
Yes. On the morning of August 20th, the remains of Robert Lamone arrived at the lab of Dr. Robert Whitmore, a forensic pathologist working under contract for the Kern County Sheriff's Coroner. Rob's body had been wrapped in three white sheets at the crime scene. A small group would witness the external and internal examinations. This included two autopsy aides to assist Whitmore, two evidence technicians shooting photographs and bagging the evidence, and one of the sheriff's investigators who took notes. So his clothing was removed and stored for inspection, as were the sterile white evidence preservation bags that had been placed on his hands when he was at the scene.
Rob's body was photographed, both clothed and nude, then weighed and measured. At death, Rob was 201 pounds and 5'11.5". As Whitmore examined the outside of the body for trauma and signs of medical procedures, he recited his findings into a recorder and made sketches. He swabbed both hands with sterile wipes for possible DNA evidence and clipped the fingernails. Then he began the internal examination. Although lab tests would still have to be done, it seemed that Robert had been a healthy 38-year-old man at the time of his death.
So what about the wounds to his body?
There's a bullet that entered the left side of his chin. This bullet shattered the left side of his jawbone, went into the mouth, grazed the left side of the spinal column of the neck, punctured a muscle in the back of the neck, and went out through the back of the neck. So that's pretty violent.
You know, bullets are violent. You see guns in movies and everything, and it's just like boom, boom, but it does horrible things to a person's body. Well, it's very violent.
When you read about it, yeah.
It's not all neat and clean like in the movies. It's horrific.
Then there was a second bullet. This wound was located on the upper right side of Robert's chest. This bullet also traveled in an upward path. The second bullet had pierced the body, hit the right collarbone, exited the body near the shoulder, and then re-entered the body through the right side of the neck. This bullet tore through the muscle that turns the neck, perforated both the right jugular vein and right carotid artery, and traveled into his head.
So Whitmore removed the bullet, and it was like the one found on the ground. It was large caliber, either a .44 or a .45. He couldn't determine the order of the shots, though both would have been fatal on their own. The shot to the chin would have taken seconds, maybe minutes, to kill Rob. The one that ended up in his head would have caused instant death. Along with upward trajectories of both shots, the wounds showed that the gun was fired at a very close range. Black-gray soot covered both entrance wounds from the burning gunpowder that would have been shooting out of the gun barrel, along with the bullets. So this meant the gun was just inches away. On the chest wound, Whitmore noticed a rectangular abrasion that could have been caused by the barrel of a handgun if it had been pressed right against the skin when it was fired. Rob had no scrapes or cuts that could be seen as defensive wounds, so he didn't do what many gunshot victims do, putting up their hands in a reflexive effort to block the shots. Due to the lack of any bullet wounds to his palms or fingers, doesn't seem like he did that. So his cause of death was determined to be gunshot wounds, and the manner of death was homicide.
Yeah, so he was shot twice, up close, from down low, and hadn't put up a fight. So this raised a couple possibilities. He could have been taken by surprise, or he was shot by somebody he knew and trusted enough to let them get close to him. So what about this nice little idyllic town that everyone lives in?
It's not really a town, right? It's more of a neighborhood?
Neighborhood.
Silver Springs?
Right, in the town.
Right. It's an unusual place because it's right out in the middle of the desert, but it's built up into a lovely neighborhood with two lakes, a golf course, an Olympic-sized pool, a clubhouse, and it has parks and playgrounds for the kids. And the community's motto is vacation where you live. So it does seem idyllic. Now, employment can be found if you live there, about 30 miles away, in small desert cities that are located on the outer fringe of commuting distance to L.A. We're about 30 miles northeast in Barstow, and that's where Rob had worked. When detectives drove out to Silver Springs to interview Sabrina Lamone, they saw that Rob had lived in a tidy one-story ranch house with a two-car garage and a really well-maintained lawn.
And there were about 30 people in the living room. Friends and relatives there to support Sabrina and her children. Detectives went into a bedroom to speak with Sabrina privately. Sabrina, at this point, didn't appear like she had sounded 4 days earlier on the phone. When on the phone, she had sounded lost and distraught. Now, however, she was pretty well put together. Very well dressed, offered them a warm smile. She certainly didn't look like she'd been recently widowed.
No, she kind of seemed like she was hosting some kind of get-together in her home.
Right. So Sabrina told the detectives that she had known Rob since she was 18 years old. They'd been married for 14 years. Sabrina denied that she or Rob had had extramarital affairs, and she said that Rob did not own a gun. The detectives found pictures of nude women on Rob's cell phone. A few were of Sabrina, but most weren't. Still, however, Sabrina insisted that Rob was never unfaithful to her.
Well, I think at first they weren't really sure if this was just some kind of porn he'd gotten online, or if it was actual people he knew.
Right.
But it would turn out that these were people that he knew and was probably having sex with, right?
Well, I think we do know that they had a group of friends they partied with, and they partied heavily.
Right.
And very often could persuade the women to take off their tops.
Kind of like Girls Gone Wild, but this was moms in their 30s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right.
So I don't know that that means he's having affairs with all the women.
No, I'm sure it doesn't mean that. But, you know, if I looked at your phone and you had all our neighbors, topless women neighbors on there, I'd say, hey, what's going on here?
Well, you probably would. And I probably wouldn't have a good explanation for that.
Probably not.
No. I'll keep that in mind, so I'll work on the explanation for when
you
do
better.
Find it.
You better, because you could be in trouble for that.
So, but that's what he had, a lot of topless women on his cell phone.
Right, which I don't think that was a big deal at the time, but it would lead to some investigation.
Yeah, well, it would certainly tweak your interest a little bit.
Well, yeah, because if someone's had an affair or their spouse has had an affair, it could always be a motive.
Right.
And I think they were thinking right away that it was a staged robbery at the murder scene.
Yeah, when they sorted things out, there wasn't really anything missing.
No.
Things were tossed around. And I guess the laptop had gone missing, but that was it.
Big deal, so, right.
So in her eulogy at Rob Lamont's funeral, Sabrina's best friend, Kelly Bernatine, described Rob and Sabrina Lamone as two of a kind. Kelly and Jason Bernatine and Sabrina and Rob Lamone were the closest of friends. They lived just a couple miles apart, and they got together two or three times a week for birthday parties, barbecues, whatever. They just hung.
Yeah, and at Christmas, they decorated extensively. At Halloween, they had elaborate costume parties. They enjoyed the nightlife, renting limos, rounding up friends from the neighborhood, and partying at their favorite bars. Every few months, they'd hire babysitters, and they'd all go off to party on Rob's boat, which he had pretty cutely named the Lamone Tree. So they drank a lot and they partied a lot, day and night. This was a big activity for them. Kind of their only hobby.
Yeah, well, you know, you're out in the desert.
Yeah, it's true.
There isn't much to do. I guess they've done all the hiking they want to do.
Maybe, yeah.
So, but yeah, that was their lifestyle.
It was.
They'd party. They'd drink a lot.
Sure.
And inhibitions were lowered.
Absolutely. That's where all the topless pictures came in.
Right. Now, this group of friends called themselves the Wolf Pack, and they could be loud and obnoxious. Not everybody in Silver Lakes approved of them. They made no apologies. This was a rowdy group of people. The Bernatines and Lamones were the leaders of the pack. Now, when Robert was killed, the Bernatines were heartbroken.
Yeah, Kelly even dedicated a Pinterest page to Rob with photos and poems and messages. And one of the messages said, "The hardest thing is not talking to someone you're used to talking to every day." She also set up a GoFundMe page to raise money for Sabrina and the kids. Family members helped Sabrina with the insurance company and employer benefits paperwork. And Kelly took charge of the funeral arrangements. She picked out music, lined up speakers, and made a slideshow, which was really heartbreaking. It was a series of photos of Rob, all the way from when he was a little boy up to his recent 38th birthday. The service drew in hundreds of people to the Grace Bible Church in Hellendale on the Saturday after Rob died. There was a big turnout, which surprised even Sabrina. But he seemed like just a likable, smiling, happy guy.
He was.
That's what he looks like in the pictures.
He looks like a guy who was happy in his life.
Yes. And they look like they really loved each other. In the pictures, at least. I mean, but pictures lie. That's why Facebook sucks, right? Because you can't trust pictures.
No.
No. But it looked that way. And everybody did say he was easygoing, nice guy.
Yeah, he didn't have really any detractors.
No.
So Rob had lived his entire life in the desert, surrounded by railroad men. He was born in Lake Havasu, Arizona in 1976, and he was the youngest of five kids. His siblings were all sisters or half-sisters, only boy in the family.
The baby.
It was a big blended family that moved around a lot. His father, Robert Sr., worked for the railroad on the tie gang, repairing and replacing railroad ties. When Robert was a baby, the family moved to Cadiz, California, which is a tiny town along the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe railroad tracks east of Barstow. They moved to Arizona when Robert was about 8 years old. So the family first went to Prescott, which is northwest of Phoenix, for Robert's elementary and junior high school years, then to the Mojave Valley near Lake Havasu. By then, Rob was just about 6 feet tall. He played defensive back for his high school team. So when Rob was in high school, his parents divorced. Rob stayed with his mother, and after graduation, he worked in construction, and he had a job with the Prescott Fire Department. He dreamed of joining the Granite Mountain Hotshots, which we've heard about because the entire elite unit lost 19 members in a 2013 wildfire.
So at a family barbecue in 1999, Rob met this beautiful 18-year-old daycare worker named Sabrina Sanmillan. Rob and Sabrina were married in August 2000 in a big church wedding. Sabrina seemed friendly and outgoing and very much in love with Robert. After Rob got his job with the railroad with the help of Julie's husband, he had to spend a couple of months in Kansas City at welding school, but then they moved to Silver Lakes, where Sabrina's parents were living. Now, Kelly Bernatine met Sabrina in 2007, when she came into Kelly's hair salon. They became friends very quickly, and after a while, Kelly introduced Jason and Rob. And these two guys got along great, and the women were really close, so they were like best friends. These were both outgoing moms who loved to go out for drinks and have fun with their husbands. Now, when the couples weren't hanging out together, Sabrina also spent hours in Kelly's salon chatting with her, gossiping, laughing, everything seemed really good.
Yeah, then in the fall of 2012, Sabrina told Kelly she was ready for a change. Both kids were now in school, and Sabrina went back to work. So she got a job handing out food samples at Costco in nearby Victorville. This job was about 20 hours a week, which allowed her time to get the kids to school and then pick them up. So Sabrina called herself a sample girl and was excited to be back working and to have money of her own. She was really friendly, too, which worked with the job. Some customers would come into the store just to talk to her and leave without buying anything. So
yeah,
the big draw was Sabrina.
She seemed very bubbly.
Yeah.
In my opinion, she wasn't so cute, but that doesn't matter. Because people liked her, right?
Don't go there.
All right, around December of 2012, one of our regular customers became more attentive. This was a young man wearing a fire department t-shirt who came to Costco to stock up on food and supplies for his station house. Sabrina and this young firefighter were chatting when she mentioned that one of her close friends, Jason Bernatine, was also a firefighter. Now, this guy knew Jason. They had worked together for a short time. And he was Jonathan Hearn. Now, Sabrina told the Bernatines about Jonathan. And Kelly did remember meeting a young fireman named Jonathan at her husband's station once. At first, Jason couldn't remember him. So he listed the guys named John that he had worked with, but none of them seemed to be the one that Sabrina had met. He told her next time to ask his last name and what station he worked at. So a few days later, she said he was employed by the city of Redlands. And Jason made the connection then. About a year earlier, he had worked with Jonathan Hearn. Jonathan was only 21 at the time, and he was classified as an LT. And that's a limited-term paramedic, working part-time on an ambulance for the County of San Bernardino Fire Department. Then, about 3 months after Sabrina mentioned Jonathan, the Bernatines ran into him. This was March 2013, and the Lamones, the Bernatines, and a bunch of others had gone to a sports bar called Beef O'Brady's. The restaurant had 15 TVs tuned to games mounted over the bar. So it's a sports bar.
It is.
A big sports bar.
Let's hang out there. Not you and I. I mean,
I was going to say, I don't think they'd have the beer you like, but we could give it a whirl. So as Jason and Kelly walked up to the bar, they saw Jonathan Hearn chatting with another firefighter. And Kelly said to him, "Oh, you know my friend Sabrina from Costco." Jonathan nodded, and then he waved Sabrina over from another part of the bar. Sabrina had a big smile on her face and raced right over to them, throwing her arms around Jonathan, hugging him, and pressing her head against his cheek. So very familiar behavior.
Very friendly.
Yeah.
But she is an outgoing person.
She's friendly.
So Jonathan was holding his almost empty mug of beer with his right hand, and he wrapped his left arm around Sabrina. Kelly then took the picture, which would later be posted on Facebook and shown on Dateline NBC. Jonathan met other people in Sabrina's group and posed for another picture taken by Kelly. This one was a group shot with Jonathan at one end and Sabrina's husband Rob at the other.
They'd also use that in the courtroom.
Right. Now, Rob was not a happy boy the next day. Sabrina told Kelly that the couple had argued, because Rob didn't like how much attention Jonathan had been showing Sabrina. He had no clue about her meeting him at Costco, and he didn't understand why he was at the same bar at the same time. So Rob asked Sabrina if something was going on between them, and Sabrina denied it. Sabrina also assured Kelly that there was nothing going on between her and Jonathan. She was 10 years older than Jonathan, and they were just friends.
I don't think it's relevant that she was 10 years older. They could still be having an affair. And I think that Rob probably knew her well enough to know something was up, or he wouldn't have been upset.
Yeah, but I think one of the things you could say, he's just a kid. I'm 10 years older than him.
Like, yeah.
Like, you know, there's
it's just
there's,
a flirtation.
Yeah, there's no way it was anything other than that.
Sure. Well, then something weird happened, though. A few days later, Jason started getting text messages from Jonathan. Jason wasn't put off by the fact that Jonathan knew his number because firefighters who've worked together always collect each other's contact information in case they need to swap shifts or call somebody in to help out. But what was weird was Jason's tone, like they were old buddies. He just said, "Hey, Jason, how's it going?" But Jason felt like he hardly knew this guy. They had worked maybe a dozen shifts together more than a year before, and they had never socialized. But Jonathan wrote weird things. He said, "You're somebody I really like, and I miss you." Jonathan mentioned that he'd met Sabrina, and it sounded like her circle of friends had a lot of fun out at Silver Lakes. He wanted to know if he could be invited to join them sometime. So Jason just tried to ignore him, even though more texts continued to come in, many of them complimenting Jason. It just seemed really weird. Like he was trying to get his way in. It almost felt to me, when I read about it, that Sabrina was trying to bring him into the group. Who knows?
I think that's a reasonable conclusion.
You think so?
Yeah.
But Jason never did invite him out to Silver Lakes. I mean, these were couples in their 30s. Why are they going to invite a 22-year-old guy?
Single guy.
Right, exactly.
These are all couples.
Yeah, it's not like he's a part of a couple.
So about the same time that these messages were coming in, the Bernatines were starting to see some subtle changes in Sabrina. Once when Kelly asked if Jonathan had stopped by the Costco lately, Sabrina snapped at her and said she didn't want to talk about it.
Whoa.
Then, one day in the spring of 2013, Jason got the weirdest text yet from Jonathan. Hey, Jason, I need your buddy Rob's phone number. Call me. So Jason called Jonathan and said, why do you need Rob's phone number? Jonathan didn't answer, but Jason thought he knew what was going on. Do you have something going on with Sabrina? He asked. So Jonathan denied it, but then said she's really important to me.
Well, just by adding that, you're not denying it anymore.
No shit.
Well, Jason got really pissed off and he started yelling at Jonathan to leave his best friend's wife alone. At the time of the phone call, Jason was actually doing work on a new house he'd bought. He was putting up drywall and Rob was there helping him. So angry, Jason gave Rob the phone, but Rob already knew about Jonathan and Sabrina's affair, which surprised Jason.
So Rob seemed resigned, but not angry. He took the phone outside and he spoke to Jonathan. Jason couldn't hear what was said, but Rob was pretty calm. When Rob ended the call and gave the phone back to Jason, he explained that Sabrina and Jonathan had still been seeing each other at Costco. They had developed some sort of intellectual relationship, as Jonathan called it. It had turned emotional. Rob knew this because he had looked at Sabrina's cell phone and found page after page of messages from Jonathan saying, I love you. So that would maybe tip you over a little bit, huh?
That's kind of, yeah, suspicious, I'd say.
So Rob at the time had been very upset and he smashed Sabrina's phone. But they'd made up. Rob said that Jonathan was calling to apologize for his behavior and to assure him that he wouldn't have anything to do with Sabrina ever again.
I don't know. Is that really necessary to call the husband? I think the best thing to do is just stay the hell away.
Yeah.
There's right? No point to talk to the husband.
Why poke a stick at a sleeping bear or something like that?
Good point, Dickie. Exactly. But Jason wasn't convinced by any of this. Rob asked him not to tell any of their other friends about it. He was embarrassed. So almost a year went by, and Kelly and Jason heard nothing more about Jonathan Hearn. Then one day in early 2014, they stopped by the Costco. Jason had had a knee injury and needed to pick up some medication, so he stayed in the car while Kelly ran into the pharmacy. When she got back to the car, she was furious. She had seen Sabrina with Jonathan. They were hanging out in one of the aisles. She'd actually made some eye contact with Sabrina, but then headed out without speaking to her. So these two are very kind of involved in the Lamones' life. A little more than any of my friends would be.
Yeah, well.
But you got the whole swapping thing going on, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know there's denials and so on back and forth about whether the Bernatines and Lamones swapped partners with each other.
Yeah, but the truth of that comes out in the trial. We'll get to that.
Right.
But when Kelly told Jason, he was angry too. And he called Jonathan's cell phone right away and told him, leave Rob's wife alone or else, pretty much. Now, after that, there was a real wall-up between the Bernatines and Sabrina. The name Jonathan Hearn wasn't even mentioned. But then Rob was killed. Let's take a quick break here to mention today's sponsors.
Okay.
So since you're listening to True Crime Brewery, you probably love true crime podcasts. Many of our listeners admit to listening to as many as 10 true crime podcasts on a regular basis. And there's a new podcast that we think you'll love called Dead Man Talking. Created with Audio Boom, Dead Man Talking is about the death row confessions of the railroad killer, Angel Resendez, who crisscrossed the U.S. by freight train in the 80s and 90s, choosing his victims at random before he was executed by the state of Texas in 2006. Before his death, Resendez spoke to journalist and host Alex Hannaford, and he claimed on tape to have killed as many as 40 people. So I really like how each episode takes one confession by Resendez and leads Alex on an investigation to find out the truth about it. And that was really fascinating and haunting. Was the railroad killer lying in order to slow down his journey to the execution chamber? Or was he even more sinister than anyone could even imagine? Dead Man Talking features interviews with the railroad killer's only surviving victim, the psychiatrist who knew him best, attorneys who worked on the case, and two inmates currently serving life sentences for crimes that Resendez claims he committed. So the way to listen to this is to visit Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast apps, and search for Dead Man Talking so you can start listening today. We highly recommend it.
Yes, we do. I give it 4 thumbs up. Your hands in my hands.
Okay, I like it.
So Jason thought that Rob had probably been killed by meth addicts out in the desert, looking for money for a fix. When he saw the security video on the news, the bulky, limping figure looked like nobody that they knew. But at the same time, something about Sabrina just wasn't right. The night Rob died, the Bernatines went over to the Lamone's house. Nobody knew anything then except that Rob was dead. Sabrina was crying, but she was very much in control. Most disturbing was that Sabrina didn't want anyone else to know that Robert had died. She wanted everyone to have one last night of good thoughts. Then she's going to tell everybody the next day, Jason remembered.
Well, that's odd.
That is a little weird, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. Because it's not like she's trying to protect her kids. They already know. So it almost seems like she's kind of ashamed of it. It almost shows some guilt to me. So weeks passed, and Jason thought more about Rob's unsolved murder, of course. It's his best friend. Then when he started thinking more and more about Jonathan Hearn, he started making some connections. Jason was still upset about Sabrina's affair. Rob had been his very best friend. And he wondered if Jonathan could have been involved in Rob's murder. But he kept pushing that idea out of his mind. It seemed far-fetched. Then he got a voicemail from Jonathan. Just kind of a rambling thing where he said, "I'd like to talk to you sometime tonight. I just got back from San Diego, and I went to Costco and talked to Sabrina last night. And I heard about Rob. I'm a little just, you know, I've been living so wrong. I've been living so wrong." Very weird voicemail.
Extremely weird.
Yeah. This was left on Friday, August 29th, less than 2 weeks after Rob's murder. After sighing one more time, Jonathan had added, "I just realized life is so short to have enemies, and you were someone I've always admired and respected for your wisdom. And you've always been so kind to me, and I have repaid that kindness with offenses, and I'm hurting our friendship. And you know what I would like to, I know it's asking a lot, I'm asking you now, though I know, I did not sleep last night." So he said a few things about God, he went on and on, and then he offered to take Jason and Kelly out to dinner before hanging up. That's... And I think Jason must have suspected him then because he was just pissed off about the whole thing.
Well, he was, and that's a really strange phone call.
Yeah, it totally is.
So that would raise my suspicions.
And again, I almost feel like Sabrina was pushing him to do this to try and make up because those are her friends and she wants him to just kind of slide into Rob's spot and be part of the group.
And just go from there.
That's my impression.
But that very night, Jason called Detective Meyer and they set up a meeting at Jason's house. Meyer asked Jason to say nothing to Sabrina about being in contact with the police. Jason agreed, although he did feel uncomfortable about going behind Sabrina's back. Jason also tried to set up a surprise meeting between Meyer and Sabrina by inviting her over to his house at the same time that the detective would be there. But he never heard anything from Sabrina. So Meyer arrived at his home. Jason told Meyer all he knew about Jonathan Hearn and his connection to Sabrina and Rob.
Well, and despite everything, Jason and Kelly did not believe that Sabrina had anything to do with Rob's murder at this point, but they weren't too sure about Jonathan. Jason described Jonathan as a really smart guy, and he thought he might be capable of planning to kill Rob so that he could have Sabrina all to himself. Meyer listened to the long voicemail that Jonathan had left, and he read the text messages. Then he asked Jason to keep their meeting quiet. He didn't want Sabrina to come over, and he didn't want Sabrina to know that Jason was even talking with the police, because he suspected her. Jason had not told Meyer that he had invited Sabrina over, and later that night he finally did hear from her. She called Jason at about 10 p.m. and apologized for not coming over. For the next few weeks, Jason and Kelly just acted like everything was the same between them and Sabrina, like the detective had wanted them to. Whatever suspicions they had about Jonathan still didn't make them suspect Sabrina necessarily.
Yeah, and Sabrina's behaving like a new widow. She posted a long Facebook tribute to Rob on September 8th, thanking everyone for their kindness. But that September, the Bernatine's attitude towards Sabrina began to change. One day Kelly saw a truck in Hellendale, and she thought the driver was Jonathan Hearn. Now, at the time, she couldn't be sure, so she just let it pass. But 3 weeks later, on Friday, September 19th, Kelly drove by Sabrina's house and saw it look like the same truck, a gray Ford pickup, parked in her driveway at 10 in the morning. When she saw Sabrina a couple days later at her house, Kelly mentioned seeing the truck. She asked if it was Jonathan's. Well, that's right to the point, isn't it? Sabrina said it wasn't. And then Kelly said, well, whose truck is it? Sabrina said it would belong to Dale Smith, an old friend. Kelly wrote down the truck's license plate number the next time she saw it, and she gave it to Meyer. Around this same time, Jason got a letter from Jonathan. This was another lengthy and strangely vague apology for disrespecting Jason and Kelly. He seemed to be overwhelmed with guilt. It seemed to be too much for simply having an affair, and this made Jason more suspicious that Jonathan had killed Rob.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he seems guilty.
Well, there's nothing that Jonathan's doing to deflect that suspicion, you know?
Not at all, no. Not at all.
So on September 23rd, Kelly drove by Sabrina's house and saw a motorcycle parked outside that she'd never seen before. It was a black antique-looking bike with the word Forgiven painted on the gas tank. She wrote down that license number and gave that to Meyer.
So she clearly doesn't trust Sabrina anymore if she's doing all this.
No, she's doing junior detective work.
She sure is, yeah.
So around the same time, Jason ran into Sabrina and her children at the local grocery store. Kids told him about their new friend named Jonathan. Sabrina hears this and abruptly changes the subject.
Yeah.
And then Jason called Detective Meyer back again with his new concerns.
Well, I guess that he really didn't realize that Meyer was suspicious and looking into all this, so he just kept calling, thinking, why aren't you doing anything?
Right.
Because this stuff takes longer than you would think. Although it's only been like a month.
Yeah, it hasn't been that long.
No. On September 26th, Kelly and Sabrina took a morning walk together, so they're still behaving like friends. And Sabrina said nothing about Jonathan, which Kelly thought was odd after what Jason had heard from the kids at the store. But Sabrina did talk about Robert's murder. It was the first time Kelly ever heard her talk about who might have killed him and why. Now, Kelly said nothing about being in touch with the police, but she actually had another interview with Meyer that afternoon to talk about the clues and her suspicions and all that. So Jason and Kelly are spending quite a bit of time talking to Meyer and doing some detective work, like you said. So Kelly told Detective Meyer about something that had happened around the time of the argument between Sabrina and Rob, when he broke Sabrina's phone. Sabrina got drunk at a wedding, and she sent a group text to several friends. Kelly peeked at Sabrina's phone, and she saw that there were several messages there from Jonathan that said things like, "You're so beautiful," and "Oh, I love you so much." So the next day, Sabrina said she had something she had to talk to Kelly about. But when Kelly asked what it was, she told Kelly she wasn't ready yet to discuss it. So that's all very curious.
Yes, it is. By early 2014, according to Kelly, when she saw Sabrina with Jonathan at Costco, she knew she couldn't trust Sabrina to be honest with her. In early September, just weeks after Rob's murder, Sabrina had told Kelly that Jonathan and his sister had come by the house with flowers. Jonathan also left a note, and Sabrina read from it. Jonathan said something like, "All the things he read in the paper and on Facebook or about Robert was that he was such an amazing man." He went on to say something to the effect of, "I'm going to try to live my life like him and that he was an inspiration. So Kelly was stunned by that letter.
Seems very inappropriate.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But Sabrina said she didn't feel that he had any bad intentions.
Well, no, she's loving it, right?
Right.
Seems like it.
And after that, Sabrina didn't mention Jonathan, and Kelly didn't bother asking Sabrina about the motorcycle in her driveway.
Well, what's the point? Because she's probably going to lie.
She's going to lie about it.
The detectives asked Kelly about the Lamones' marriage, and Kelly said that after she and Sabrina had been friends for a few years, Sabrina had confided that she and Rob had an open relationship with another couple. So, with this other couple, they would swap spouses and stay in different motel rooms. Kelly wasn't sure how long that had gone on, but she knew that the other couple had ended up divorcing. The couple was Dale Smith and his wife. That's the same Dale who Sabrina had claimed had parked his truck at her house. Sabrina had said that she had remained friendly with Dale. Information shared by Jason and Kelly really helped to steer the investigation in a new direction. Sabrina had denied having any issues in their marriage, and she had insisted that Rob didn't have a girlfriend and they didn't have an open marriage. But Meyer asked Kelly and Jason if they were involved in the swinging life with the Lamones, and they denied it. They seemed straightforward, but Meyer wasn't so sure if he believed them about the swinging. At least one of the photos found on Rob Lamone's phone was of Kelly topless.
So Detective Meyer checked DMV records and discovered that Jonathan drove a diesel-powered Ford pickup and a Yamaha motorcycle. The license plate numbers Kelly had given him showed both were registered to Jonathan Hearn. Aha.
Right, so they're not being very careful either.
Nope. Databases also showed that Jonathan owned handguns, including a .45 caliber pistol.
So all that is pointing in his direction as the guilty party.
That's going to make people take a closer look at him, isn't it?
Sure.
Now, after finding the security video of the limping man, police gathered security footage from nearby businesses. A company down the street from the industrial complex had a camera aimed at the entrance. Since the street dead ends into the industrial park, the camera recorded every vehicle and pedestrian going to and from the murder scene. So they tracked down the drivers of most of the vehicles, and everyone had an alibi. The most significant footage was of a motorcycle. With a black helmet that hid the face, the motorcyclist rode an older model bike with a silver gas tank and silver tailpipe. This motorcycle first appeared at 4:12 p.m. traveling away from the industrial park. Then 3 minutes later, at 4:15, the rider returned, heading toward the complex, only to reappear 2 minutes later, again driving away. And at 4:21 p.m., the motorcycle rode past the complex again, and in another 50 minutes, at 5:11 p.m., the rider was again pictured driving toward the complex. The last time the motorcycle was seen was at 5:48 p.m., again heading to the complex.
So does this mean he was kind of like trying and backing out and debating? Is that what all this activity means?
Yeah, or just doing reconnaissance? I don't know.
Huh, okay.
Now, the camera did not show a motorcycle leaving the scene. Now, Detective Meyer sent an agent to check gas stations, stores, and restaurants nearby for security camera footage. And this paid off at a gas station truck stop called Pilot Travel Center. On the day of the murder, a security camera showed a motorcyclist in a black helmet pull in at 6:51 p.m. The rider then walked into the mini-mart. The driver held his hand up to his face as he looked up at the security camera. Inside the mini-mart, another camera showed him wearing a helmet, getting a water bottle, and Gatorade from the cooler. The cash register showed that the items, along with enough gas for a motorcycle, had been purchased with cash. The person then went back outside and gassed up the motorcycle. He drank something and walked toward the trash can, and then he returned to the motorcycle. The rider drove away from the gas station on Highway 395 towards Silver Lakes, and beyond that, Hesperia. And that's where Jonathan Hearn lived, in Hesperia.
So we're closing in on this guy.
So we're starting to, yep.
But the motorcyclist's face couldn't be seen in any of the footage, even though police were sure it was him. He did own a motorcycle. He'd had a relationship with the victim's wife before and after the murder. So these facts alone got Meyer a search warrant, The warrant got them phone company records for any cell phones or landlines in the names of Jonathan Hearn and Sabrina Lamone. So every call and text message from the time the two met at Costco to the present were accessed by them. Now this, as you can imagine, is a huge amount of data to go over. Incoming and outgoing calls, text messages, and multimedia messages, which includes the photos and the videos. Jonathan's cell phone and Sabrina's cell and landline connected a lot. But it mostly stopped in late April of 2014. But just at the same time, a new number popped up on Jonathan's cell phone records, and it began to dominate his records. 7,000 calls and texts from April to October. Phone company records had no information on the number. It was a burner phone. So the records showed its user was in nearly constant contact with Jonathan before, during, and after Rob Lamone's murder. From August 1st to the 16th, the day before Rob was killed, there were 1,902 text messages between Jonathan's cell phone and the burner. That's an average of more than 100 messages a day. Now, nobody has that many messages except a teenager.
I'm crazy. Not even sure a teenager could do that.
Oh, I think they do.
Holy cow.
But it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then there were another 117 multimedia messages, which is probably photos that they were exchanging. And then on August 17th, which was the day of the murder, there was an influx of phone calls and texts between his phone and the burner. So Jonathan's phone got texts from about 1:30 to 5:04 p.m., and then there was nothing till 6:57 p.m., so that just leaves open the time when Rob was killed. Seems kind of obvious.
Well, maybe not obvious. Suspicious, let's say.
Constant contact, and then for like almost 2 hours around the time of the murder, No contact. Then Jonathan's cell and burner had two voice calls at 7:50 and 8:37 p.m., followed by more than 50 texts that continued all night until 6:48 the next morning. I mean, you might as well just wear a big flashing red light on your head that says, "I'm the killer."
Yeah. That's me on the phone.
Yeah.
Throughout August, Jonathan and the burner phone exchanged 2,500 texts and 120 voice calls. So Detective Meyer believed that the burner was being used by Sabrina. The way to find this out for sure would be to use a wiretap.
Right. So the room where the calls were going to be listened to had to be monitored 24 hours a day. With resources already really tight, the 8 members of the Kern County Sheriff Robbery Homicide Division needed help from other departments and agencies. The wiretaps were really crucial to this case. The phone records tracked the number of calls, when they were made, and between which numbers, but they didn't tell you what was actually said or sent. So if Sabrina and Jonathan had conspired to murder Rob, they really needed to know what they were saying to each other. They began listening to Sabrina and Jonathan's calls in November 2014. The first call came in at 10:39 p.m. on November 7th. It was Jonathan's cell phone calling the burner. "Hi, baby," came a male voice. "Hey," came a soft female voice. "How are you?" "I'm good," the man said. "How are you, baby?" So a few seconds in, and the conversation was already revealing some real intimacy between these two people.
Certainly looks that way.
They are not subtle.
Nope.
Within minutes, detectives had tons of circumstantial evidence. Two lovers talking about the Rob Lamone murder investigation. The operation had a potential problem, though, when Sabrina expressed concern that her phones were being tapped. So detectives decided they were going to tickle the wire, which means saying or doing something to get the suspects talking.
So on the morning of Sunday, November 9th, Detective Meyer sent Sabrina a text message asking her to call him and then waited to see what she did. The first thing she did was to call Jonathan on her burner phone. "I just got a text message from Detective Meyer and he asked me to call him." "Oh, great," said Jonathan, although he didn't sound like it was great. "God, please help us," Jonathan prayed. "Help Sabrina to have the right words." The prayer was interrupted by one of Sabrina's kids in the background trying to get her attention. "You have to give Mommy a few minutes for an important phone call," she said. "Go watch the movie, whatever is on, and just relax." Then to Jonathan she said, "I'm sorry." "We have a purpose, we have a vision," Jonathan continued to pray out loud. They each said, I love you, before they hung up.
Sabrina called Detective Meyer back at 10:15 a.m. He sounded friendly, and he apologized for texting her on a Sunday. But he said he wanted to update her. Detectives were considering re-releasing to the public the surveillance video of the man walking with a limp near the crime scene. He told her the investigation was at a dead end. He said he just wanted to give her a warning in case somebody saw it on the news. Sabrina told Meyer that she was sad and she couldn't believe Rob had been murdered. He had told her police were trying to make an enhanced, clearer version of the surveillance footage, but that would take a couple of months. So after she hung up with the detective, Sabrina called Jonathan right back. Everything's fine, she told him. I'll talk to you after church when I see you. He just said that they don't have anything and that they're re-releasing the same video, she told him. So she said she was bringing the children to church and suggested Jonathan join them for a picnic in the park afterwards. Along with showing Sabrina and Jonathan's complicity, the calls showed how manipulative Sabrina could be, because she changed from this dazed and confused widow on the phone with Meyer to a very perky and clear woman with Jonathan. There was a lot of talk about love and God and prayer. From background checks on Jonathan, Detective Meyer knew that he was taking classes to become an arson investigator, and part of Jonathan's instruction covered the basics of criminal investigation, including interviewing techniques. So after a while, Jonathan began to think that he and Sabrina were suspects and they were being played by investigators. He tried to talk less about the investigation on the phone, but this couple seemed unable to help themselves. Sabrina talked about whether Robert's death was part of a larger plan by God. Robert's not here, she said. Why? It doesn't feel real. Then she said that instead of asking God why, she should be asking him to use me. I want to be used, Jonathan said, whatever God wants for me. Sabrina wondered out loud what would have happened if Rob had survived the shooting. He wouldn't want to be in a wheelchair just breathing through or not being able to get up. He would not. I just think about that all the time. I think I would have taken care of him. I would have. I know you would have, said Jonathan. I would have as his wife, she said. As his wife, there are certain honors I owe him, just as the title of being his wife. She remembered something Rob had told her just weeks before he died. Sabrina, if I died tomorrow, I would die happy. So Sabrina said, timing is crazy, and that's where I find peace. It doesn't feel real. It feels like the purpose that he left me with was part of God's plan. She said she felt that God has placed Robert here to make everyone's eyes open, to inspire other people to follow Rob's love and kind deeds that he did for everyone. She talked about their life and her wonderful memories of Rob. Now Jonathan called Sabrina from the fire station where he was finishing a 24-hour shift. He was exhausted and he rambled on about a lot of things that were going through his mind. We are dirty, rotten sinners, he said. We are spiders dangling from a thread. All it takes is a little snap of the finger and we're destroyed. I don't want that. Sabrina told him it was all part of God's plan, and she suggested that Robert may have been better off dead. This was God's time for him, she said. People are coming out of the woodwork saying Rob's life left a positive impact on them. For me to be part of that, I feel so blessed. The memories that my kids have, they're off playing right now, but God has a plan for us. Daddy is our guardian angel, they say. The alternative, she said, could have been a lot worse. If Rob and I did separate, maybe God didn't want that for him or for the kids. I just feel bad being my old chipper self. I'm known for my sunshine. That's what everyone knows me for. I feel horrible about who I am. Although it didn't really sound like she felt horrible.
No, I think she's just saying that to try to convince herself.
That she did the right thing?
That she did the right thing.
Mm.
And it's just...
It's not very convincing.
It isn't.
Very warped.
It's just the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
In all this is just astounding.
It's disgusting, really. Can you imagine someone has you killed and says... What was best for him?
Yeah, it's God's plan.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
It's terrible.
So detectives followed Jonathan Hearn, and they saw him throw away some motorcycle pipes at a Target store dumpster. This led them to believe that he had changed out his exhaust pipes to make his motorcycle look different. So this gave them further belief that he had traveled on that motorcycle when he killed Rob. Detective Meyer sent Sabrina a text of a still shot of Jonathan on the motorcycle the night of Rob's murder. The message underneath said, "We think we found our guy." She immediately called Jonathan, who was beginning to believe police were closing in on her. 2 days later, Sabrina and Jonathan were arrested. By now, Jason and Kelly were convinced of her guilt. However, on the day Sabrina was scheduled to be arraigned, she's released. The DA didn't have enough evidence against her, so the case against Jonathan was much stronger than the case against Sabrina.
Well, sure, there was circumstantial evidence against Jonathan, including the security footage. But all they had against Sabrina were the wiretap conversations. And even after hours of recording these conversations, she never did say that she conspired to kill Rob with Jonathan. And even after intense interrogation by police, Sabrina didn't reveal anything. She denied any knowledge of Jonathan being the killer, too. So after her release, none of Sabrina's friends stood by her, though. Sabrina told her sister, Julie, that she was innocent and that she could not believe that Jonathan would be involved in this either. Sabrina and her kids were harassed in the community, and Sabrina ended up relocating over 100 miles away. So it was more than 2 years after Rob's murder, and just weeks before Jonathan's murder trial was to start, that Jonathan told investigators he was ready to talk about Sabrina. This was in late 2016. Jonathan confessed to shooting Rob Lamone, but he said that Sabrina had helped him plan it from the start. She wanted Rob out of the way so she could be with Jonathan, but she didn't think that divorce was an option. She was worried that the community would not approve of her getting a divorce. So to her, murder was preferred to divorce. Now this kind of thinking, which we've seen before, astounds me. Why would you think that people won't approve of you getting a divorce, but that murdering is going to be the solution?
Well, because you think that you'll never get caught for the murder.
But that's just not realistic.
No, it isn't. Not entirely, anyway.
Plus, it's such a self-centered way of thinking to think that your life is so important that you can just get rid of someone else's.
An inconvenient person.
Very psychotic.
Yeah.
So Jonathan didn't have any hard evidence to prove her involvement. The wiretaps proved an affair, but there was no explicit mention of a murder plot. So it was essentially his word against hers. Prosecutors offered Jonathan a plea deal. So if he would testify in court against Sabrina, his charge would be dropped to voluntary manslaughter, which is quite a bargain. I mean, he shot this guy in cold blood. So he took the deal.
Well, sure. I mean, it's almost like a get-out-of-jail-free card. He's going to be pleading voluntary manslaughter, and he could be out within 25 years versus life in prison.
So I guess the love is gone between these two. I thought it was eternal love. It didn't last that long.
I guess not. No. Eternity isn't that long, is it?
No, not when you're faced with life in prison.
So the trial was streamed live on the local news network's website. The state had a lot of evidence of the affair, including phone call transcripts, texts, and sexually suggestive photos. They seemed to justify their actions by saying that they had a purpose set out by God once they were together.
Sure, I mean, Jonathan testified that Sabrina was irresistible to him, and not just sexually. She had told him that Rob objectified her with an open marriage where she was pawned off on other men so he could have sex with their wives. He said that the idea to kill Rob started out as kind of a joke, but over time it turned into an actual plot to kill her husband. Sabrina, Jonathan said, told him that she believed Rob would rather be dead than divorced. So their first idea to kill Rob was to poison him. In April of 2014, Jonathan said he made up a batch of banana pudding and stirred some arsenic into it. And the plan was for Sabrina to put it in Rob's lunch. Sabrina had kept the poisoned pudding in her refrigerator, but they changed their minds, kind of got scared, I guess. And Sabrina told Rob not to eat the pudding because the bananas were bad. But then, by August 2014, they hatched their new plan.
Yes, Sabrina told him that Rob would be working on August 17th. Jonathan testified that he packed a mask and changed the appearance of his motorcycle. He rode out to where Rob was working in Tehachapi. He was apprehensive and he paused to pray before he entered the building. He went in and shot Rob once. He staged the scene to look like a robbery. Then, to make sure Rob was dead, he fired a second shot into Rob's head. Jonathan told the jury that he knew he would be a suspect because of the affair, but he trusted Sabrina.
While Sabrina's attorney questioned Jonathan's credibility, one thing he pointed out was that Sabrina would not have put poisoned food in a refrigerator because the kids might get into it. Kind of a lame argument.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the defense never tried to deny that Sabrina was unfaithful to her husband. They made the case all about how Jonathan Hearn planned to carry out Rob's murder on his own. They portrayed Jonathan as an intelligent master manipulator. Even when he was supposedly madly in love with Sabrina, he was texting another older woman that he had met online.
And on the witness stand, Kelly Benatine admitted that she and Jason were involved in swinging with Sabrina and Rob. Now, this is usually Sabrina and Kelly together, and then they would have sex with their own husbands.
So I think this was kind of the thing where the guys would watch the women together?
Yeah.
Sabrina testified in her own defense, which I thought was a pretty risky move. Sabrina told the jury what had attracted her to Jonathan Hearn. She said at the time she met him that her husband was not attentive to her, and he was obsessed with porn and sex outside of the marriage. She claimed that Jonathan controlled her by using religion to make her feel safe with him. And she did admit to dreaming of a future with Jonathan, but she said she still loved her husband, even though she loved Jonathan too, and that she had the best of both worlds, having both men in her life. After Rob's death, she said, Jonathan was there for her, and he supported her in her grief. She insisted that she never planned to kill Rob, and that she had no idea that Jonathan was Rob's killer. She also insisted that she didn't want Rob dead. Kelly would go on the stand and claim that the whole open marriage idea had been Sabrina's, not Rob's really at all. And in Sabrina's cross-examination, the prosecutor used transcripts of her calls and texts to really undermine her claims that she didn't want Rob out of the way and that she didn't want a life with Jonathan. Her whole claim was that she was being controlled by Jonathan, and the prosecutor was really trying to get rid of that whole idea. It almost seemed as if she was just trying to replace Rob with Jonathan. But there was also a financial incentive, right?
Well, she got a $300,000 life insurance policy, and there was going to be a payment at some point from the railroad.
For a large payment.
A large, up to $2 million.
Because he was on the job.
Because he was on the job, and they're looking at what he would have earned over the next several years.
Right.
Till retirement. So she was looking at a pretty significant payout.
Well, she would have been pretty well taken care of for life, it sounds like.
Right. So Sabrina was found guilty of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and accessory to murder. She was found not guilty for attempted murder by using the arsenic-laced banana pudding. She was sentenced to 25 years to life.
Right, and there have been appeals which have gone nowhere. So it looks like she's there for the duration.
It does, although by squealing and ratting her out, he got the lighter sentence, even though he was the one who did the physical killing.
Right. That's kind of upsetting when you think about it.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, the entire trial can be watched on YouTube, and Dateline did a good episode on this case called Secrets in Silver Lakes. I try and watch the whole trial, but it was pretty dry. I did watch her testimony and his, but...
It was pretty dry.
It's hard to watch an entire trial. I don't have the attention span for that, or the time, really. But it's interesting. So before we get on to feedback, which we have a pretty good feedback section today, I'd just like to remind everyone about Team Tie Grabber, which is our members-only podcast feed, where we have original episodes coming out every month, and you can go to our website, tiegrabber.com, to sign up to get access. Also, we're going to send you a gift when you sign up. You get a snifter or one of our really cool bottle openers. Plus, I have a lot of swag that I'm giving out. I have magnets and all kinds of stuff. So if you want to sign up and give us some support, we'd really appreciate it. Also, you can offer support through Patreon at patreon.com/truecrimebrewery, where you'll also get a gift and access to the members-only episodes. We recently did an episode on Samantha Zaldivar, who was a 7-year-old who went missing from her trailer park. And in October, we're doing the disappearance of Shannon Matthews, who I think she was 9 when she disappeared. But I believe this is a case with a happy ending.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. All right. What have we got for feedback today, Dick?
We got a couple of voicemails. The first one is from Chandra in upstate New York. She has a comment on all her children.
Okay.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Chandra from upstate New York. I love listening to your podcast, and you guys actually inspired me to do my own. I just wanted to let you know, because I'm not sure if you saw it, but Mary Beth Pinning actually was just released from prison on parole on August 21st. I cannot believe that New York State let her out. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Chandra. I mean, I really understand where you're going with this Mary Beth Pinning, because she was an evil woman.
She certainly was, and I know, at least by the letter of the law, she was eligible for parole. She'd been before the parole board on other occasions. But then I'm reminded that she likely killed 6, 7, 8 kids and was only convicted of killing 1.
Right.
So I would have kept her in jail forever.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, I don't know, there was probably some mental illness there, but she was also evil. And if she didn't admit to what she did, that's the thing. I feel like if she was going to get out, she should have confessed to everything she did. Because if she's still lying about killing those other kids, then she clearly has not been cured, or whatever you want to call it.
She is not rehabilitated.
No, that's a better word, rehabilitated. So what do we have next?
We have another voicemail from Devin in Colorado.
All right.
And she's commenting on my mother, my killer.
Okay.
Teresa Knorr case that we did recently.
She killed her daughters, yeah.
Yeah.
A real psychopath. All right, let's hear what Devin has to say.
Hello, Jill and Dick. I have previously left a 5-star review, and I recommend your show to all my friends and family. But your latest show about Teresa Knorr, my mother, my killer, left me physically cold. My mother is a classic sociopath exhibiting mood chosen by proxy. She had extreme mental, sexual, physical, emotional abuse to me and my 5 siblings. I left the house at 14. The striking resemblance of this story is remarkable, and I just am really thankful that me and my siblings came out alive. But sadly, me and my sister are the only functioning members of society. Most are on drugs, have extreme mental conditions, have been in and out of prison. I actually have a younger sister. She's the youngest, and she is my mother's caretaker, and she still lives in the home with her 2 young children. So it just terrifies me about the possibilities. And for the last 20 years, I've told everyone who will listen about my case, and I report them yearly to every authority, including the FBI, and nothing has ever been done. I cannot stress enough about how absent protection is for the most vulnerable children in our society. So I really thank you for raising awareness. On to another note, if you ever cover the Chris Watts case here in Colorado that just occurred, where he killed his wife, Shannon, and who was pregnant, and their 2 young daughters, there's an amazing beer from Garfunkel out of Boulder, Colorado. It's a rye saison, and it might do you a little bit good, Dick, to pick something other than a stout or a porter, because for all of us reluctant beer drinkers, that's a hard one. So this rye saison is really light. It's really complex, and I think a lot of people would like it. Thank you guys so much, and I really appreciate the work and the awareness that you do. Please keep up the good work, and enjoy your new home in New Mexico.
Well, thanks, Devin. So a lot to unpack here with Devin.
Yeah, I'm just listening to this and thinking, oh, man, you should listen to that episode, and it was just ringing so true for
her. Must have been hard, yeah.
Hard one.
Yeah.
But I don't know what else you can do except what you're doing. Keep notifying authorities.
Yeah, and the strength and the bravery of coming out of that and being functional.
Yeah.
But how scary to think about her sister and kids living there with the woman.
I know, particularly the two little kids.
Yeah. It just goes to show you how vulnerable we all are to what situation we're born into.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
And so, I'd also would say that the suggestion of trying a review of a Saison, or at least getting away from the IPAs and stouts and so on, great idea.
Yeah. I think more variety might be in order. Sure.
I think so. I've drunk Saisons. I like them. They're very crisp and usually pretty delicious, so it shouldn't be too big a burden.
No, I'm sure it won't be a burden.
Do some reviews of other styles.
Okay. So. All right, great. And what else did she say? Oh, the Chris Watts case.
Yeah, we're planning on doing that.
We're planning on doing that. It's just, it's kind of funny. We were in Colorado that week.
Yeah, when
that happened.
When it broke.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Devin, and cheers to you. What else do we have?
We have some other mails. So first, let me read you something from Kate from Australia.
Okay. And could you read that in an Australian accent for me, please?
I doubt it.
Okay.
But she has a case suggestion. And Kate had a very long letter that I have edited. So first, I'll apologize to Kate for cutting out most of her letter.
And just let her know that we did read it and enjoy it. We just cut it out for the episode.
We just had to trim it a little.
Okay.
Because we wanted to talk about the episode.
Sure.
So Kate says, "Hi there, friends over the pond." There are a few other cases that Tiger Rubber podcast lovers have suggested, including the Ivan Milat case. OMG. Now that is one crazy sick SOB. An intense case, brutal and horrifying, but incredibly interesting. Mentioned, I think, that I've studied crime and I was at uni doing my bachelor degree for criminology. So digging and researching criminals is my thing. Said that, really. Ha ha. We have that in common, though. Again, could help you on any Aussie cases you think are worthy of an episode. Keep up your amazing work, guys.
Thanks, Kate. That's a great offer.
We'll take you up on that.
Yeah.
So what she's talking about are called the Backpacker Murders. And these were a spate of serial killings that took place in New South Wales, Australia, between 1989 and 1993. And these were committed by Ivan Milat. The bodies of seven missing young people, aged 19 to 22, were found partially buried in Bulangio State Forest in New South Wales. Five of the victims were foreign backpackers visiting Australia, three Germans and two British, and two were Australian travelers from Melbourne. Milat was convicted of the murders on July 27, 1996, and is currently serving seven consecutive life sentences, as well as 18 years without parole, at the maximum security Goulburn Correctional Center. So that's where we are. I think that'd be an interesting one to look into.
Yeah, that has been recommended before, hasn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But we had kind of steered away from serial killers. But now we're kind of open to doing one here and there. Like we decided to do Ed Kemper in December.
We're going
to
do him.
We could do that one too.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an interesting one. And I was looking, there's plenty of information.
Okay, good.
Okay, then we have a note from Robin talking about the beauty school murder.
Okay.
That's Mackenzie Cowell.
Do you want me to read that?
It's all yours.
Dick and Jill, I've lived in the Wenatchee area my entire life. We are a pretty small community with fairly low serious crime rates. I was a senior in high school when she went missing. Things like this don't happen often. There's been maybe a total of 10 murders that I know of in the area over my 27 years. I personally do believe that he did it, but I also heard a lot of community gossip, and I am somewhat biased. However, the bloodstains and the pictures showing Tessa lying in an unnatural position where the blood was is just too much to be unrelated, in my eyes. That's not the behavior of a normal person who hasn't done anything wrong. Could the police have fabricated evidence? Sure, but I can tell you from personal experience, many of the local cops are less than stellar in the execution of their jobs. I doubt they would go to the lengths of that just to put someone away for murder. So this kind of cracks me up because she's saying the main reason they wouldn't set up someone is they're just kind of too lazy to bother.
Right.
Yeah. But that was a horrible crime, and I didn't feel like they had a ton of evidence against him.
No, they didn't.
So, but it did kind of seem like he did it, but yeah, that was an iffy case, though, as far as finding him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And a lot of people do support him.
Yes, he has a lot of support.
He does.
But he's still in prison.
But what a horrible shame that that girl was killed. As they all are, I know, but each time I just think of her, I just think it's so sad.
Well, yeah, well, you always get depressed about some people just at the start of their lives.
Sure.
You know, she's got all this stuff to look forward to, and some idiot kills her.
Well, and as a parent, I just picture her father's reaction and what he went through. It's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one is from Nikki, and this is a suggestion.
Right. I looked into this, and I'm thinking, wow. She wanted to do a show on Tim Hennis and the Eastbourne murders.
Okay, I've never heard of that.
I hadn't either, but it happened at Fort Bragg.
Oh, same place as Jeffrey McDonald?
Back memories of Jeffrey McDonald.
Right.
So this is about a master sergeant who had been acquitted by a North Carolina court more than 20 years previously, was found guilty of murder in a court-martial at Fort Bragg.
And that was in 2010?
Hennis had been convicted at his original trial for the 1985 stabbing murders of Catherine Eastbourne and her two young daughters, Erin and Kara, who lived just outside Fort Bragg. Hennis was a sergeant and parachute rigger stationed at Bragg at the time. So he was sentenced to death in 1986 by the state of North Carolina. But then the state's Supreme Court later overturned the conviction and ordered a new trial for Hennis, in which he was acquitted in 1989. So he returned to active duty in the Army upon his acquittal and served until 2004, when he honorably retired as a master sergeant. Then in 2006, new DNA evidence was found which was not available in the 1980s. The Army then recalled Hennis to active duty in order to face a court-martial. So they did this because of the double jeopardy rule.
Because
he had been convicted in civilian court of murder and then acquitted. So they couldn't do that. They couldn't try him in civilian court.
So he had been charged and acquitted. He hadn't been convicted.
He was convicted, retried on appeal, and then acquitted.
Oh, right. Okay. Gotcha.
So what they did was they put him back in the Army so he could be court-martialed for the murders.
I didn't know they could just pull someone back into the Army.
I didn't either.
That's amazing.
It's very interesting. And so that's what they did. The evidence that they found was that Hennis's sperm was in the dead body of Catherine Eastbourne.
The mother?
The mother of the two children.
Oh, well, that makes you pretty guilty, I think.
You would think that there's some interesting stuff.
Okay.
So all the evidence pointed squarely at the accused guy because his DNA was inside the dead woman. Now, his lawyers said that he was innocent. He wasn't the guy who did these crimes. They argued that the DNA did not indicate murder, only that the two may have had an affair sometime before the slayings, which you would think sounds like desperate grabbing for something.
Sure.
But here's the big thing. They found male DNA under the fingernails of all three murder victims, and it's not him.
Wow.
Some other male. So I just think that's fascinating.
So I assume they already tested any other males in their lives for that DNA?
They just know that it's male DNA. So I'm wondering how, yes, it's Hennis's sperm or Hennis's DNA that's inside the dead woman, but there's some other guy, the other guy's DNA under their fingernails.
So if he was in some kind of relationship with her, it's possible.
And it seems entirely possible to me, although we definitely got to look into this.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure. Interesting one. So thanks, Nikki. Good suggestion.
Thank you very much.
Then we have a comment on Disposable Woman by Oh Man. So Disposable Woman is the case of Raina Angelica Merrickin.
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 Yeah.
All right, and this is the woman whose body was in a barrel for like 30 years before they figured it out, and it was just sitting in someone's basement.
Right.
So, O-Man says, one of the TV shows about this case disclosed that there was a third partner at the plastics factory, Elkin's father-in-law. Now, we didn't know this, and this wasn't in our episode.
No, this is new stuff.
It also claimed that Elkins told police that his brief affair with the girlfriend he supposedly couldn't remember ended so soon because Elkins' father-in-law found out about the affair and made him end it. I wonder if this is why he decided not to get divorced to marry Raina to raise her baby. He would lose his family and his job. No wonder he was so furious that Raina called his wife. He probably had told his father-in-law that the affair ended when Raina quit her job at the plastics factory. Elkins then had Raina live in a secret apartment in Hoboken, New Jersey. Raina's call to the wife exposed him as still having the affair, and now as having sired a child with his mistress. He had to get rid of her and the baby and claim the call was a prank. His wife and father-in-law must have believed that because there were no further calls or anything else about this baby or the woman. The thing that always amazes me is that Elkins left the barrel when he sold the house. He should have gotten rid of it somehow. He had from the time of the murder in 1969 until when he sold the house in 71 or 72 to figure out something. He was lazy or dumb or both. In the TV show I mentioned, the third partner in the plastics factory, Gantman, is shown, and he says Elkins was the brawn in the three-way partnership. Perhaps Elkins was big, burly, and stupid. One final comment, was Elkins' wife's name Patrice, or does he have a daughter named Patrice like on the locket? If not, who was Patrice? Who was Uncle Phil mentioned on the locket? See, I didn't think that locket had any connection to Elkins.
Yeah, I didn't get that impression either.
But that's a good question. Who was Patrice? That's something that we don't know.
No, we don't.
So this is interesting.
Nor do we know Uncle Phil.
Right, right. What gets me, which I think is funny, is that O-Man says, I don't understand why he left it there. He had all this time to get rid of it. And I think when you listen to or follow enough of these true crime cases, you find yourself thinking, well, just do this, stupid, and you'll get away with it.
Yeah.
Even though you don't want the person to get away with murder.
Right.
But you can sit and think, well, how can you get away with that anyway? It's just the way the brain goes, I guess.
You should have done this.
I always find myself doing that, so I thought that was funny.
Definitely.
Yeah, but thank you, O-Man. I haven't researched that at all with the third partner and all that, but that is interesting.
Very.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a nice addition to the story. That's why I feel that your time is better spent writing to us than writing to a podcast that's a bunch of experts and they already know everything. So if you write to us, you're actually contributing to our story because we find out a lot from our listeners and from our feedback.
Support for this podcast comes from Park Row Books, publisher of Under My Skin, by New York Times bestselling author Lisa Unger. Under My Skin is an addictive psychological thriller about a woman on the hunt for her husband's killer. Poppy is determined to unravel the mystery around her husband's death, but can she handle the truth about what really happened? Listen to the audiobook for Under My Skin today.
Well, that wraps it up, Dick. I don't have any more feedback. I got nothing more to say to you.
Okay.
Thank you to Tristan Capel for producing our original True Crime Brewery theme. And thank you to everyone who has listened to our podcast. We appreciate that you're willing to take some time out of your busy day to listen to us.
Let's have some lattes with the hipsters.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. See you next time.
See you next time at the Quiet End. Bye-bye.
Bye.